This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After a brain hemorrhage and stroke, my guest, John Sarkin, was transformed. He had been a kind of quiet chiropractor, husband, and father. After the stroke, he became a compulsive artist. He couldn't stop drawing. He drew on everything: paper, guitar cases, walls, boxes. His art looks obsessive. When he isn't drawing, he's writing. Many of his drawings include words, sometimes fragments of sentences that may or may not make sense to the viewer, sometimes one word written over and over and over in the margin. Some of his portraits have so much cross-hatching, they appear to be pulsating. Other portraits are of imaginary creatures that are elaborately patterned. Although Sarkin is a changed person, his marriage has stayed together. His art has been shown in galleries around the world. Now he's the subject of the new book, Shadows Bright as Glass, that examines what happened to his brain and how that has manifested itself in his art. The book is by journalist Amy Ellis Nutt, who was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in feature writing for her series about Sarkin. John Sarkin, Amy Ellis Nutt, welcome to Fresh Air. John, I want to start with you. Would you describe the difference between who you were before the stroke and who you are now?
Yeah, before the stroke, I was a chiropractor, and I thought in a much more linear fashion about stuff. That's what doctors do. They think in a very organized, linear way, where it's basically an algorithmic way of thinking. Now it's more of a stream of consciousness, holistic, nonlinear way of thinking.
And there's a difference that before the stroke, you had enjoyed sketching and painting, and after the stroke, you became, can we say, a compulsive artist?
Yeah. Before the stroke, I enjoyed it from a purely non-vocational point of view. Just I enjoyed doodling on vacations. I enjoyed doodling while I was talking on the phone. We had a party at my house. Sometimes I'd design the invitations. But never in my wildest dreams did I ever have a thought that I could somehow make this more vocational. Now, obviously, it is. And I create art all the time because that's what I do, both from a professional standpoint and also a compulsive standpoint.
Amy Ellis Nutt, what medical mysteries did you want to understand by writing this book about John, his stroke, and how it transformed him?
There were a number of things. The first and most striking thing about John's case is that people who suffer identity disorders from a stroke or brain disease are usually people who are unable to reflect on who they were before. John is that rarest of individuals who was acutely aware and is acutely aware of what he lost and how he changed and the fact that he was a radically different man in body and soul. So I was fascinated by this aspect of someone knowing that they are essentially two selves, a former self and a present self, and how that works. And in essence, what makes us who we are? Is it memory? Is it emotion? Is it cognition? Is it personality? And I think all of those things play a part in John's story. And coupled with that, I've always had an interest in sort of the philosophical issues of identity and consciousness. And it seemed to me that their stories paralleled beautifully in terms of philosophy and neuroscience's search for identifying where in the brain we can say identity rests, and John's search to understand himself.
John, what do you miss, or do you miss anything about who you were before the stroke?
You know, my canned response to that, which I think is a good one, is the documentary that Bob Dylan was done about Bob Dylan about his 1966 tour to England is called Don't Look Back. And that's what I'm all about these days, is I don't look back. I don't even entertain that question because I know that it's not productive to engage in gazing in my rearview mirror in life.
So forgive me while I ask Amy to do that on your behalf. Amy, you've extensively interviewed John's wife. What does she say about the difference between who he was before and after the stroke, and what does she miss about who he was before?
Well, the stroke also happened early in their marriage. I think they'd only been married really 2 years. They had a 9-month-old son. So Kim often describes this as a very blissful time. They even, you know, would say to one another, I can't believe how happy we are. So she, in a way, was just getting to know John. I mean, they had dated for a while, but it was still early in their marriage. She talks now about missing the man who was able to empathize with her, looking forward to the future, someone who wanted to provide for his family and, you know, lead a fairly typical life. Kim is someone who is completely taken with being a mother, and her life has been raising children. And when the stroke happened, Kim not only wondered whether or not John would survive, but what would be the husband she would get back and what would happen with their plans for family.
Does she feel like she's now married to a different man than the man that she married?
I think she does in some ways. She knows, you know, John is the same man. And I think that over time, she's discovered more of the things about John that have remained. But she knows, you know, very clearly that John is concerned with different things, that his life very much centers around art, and that he's not the same man. But Kim is an amazing story in and of herself because she felt, you know, she had married John, she loved John, and she was going to make the marriage work through thick or thin.
And the marriage has stayed together, held together.
Yes. They went on to have 2 more children, and they have really 3 amazing kids. Curtis, Robin, and Carolyn are, you know, just really terrific, terrific kids.
John, you're so obsessed with your art now. Do you care much about people?
Yep, I do. I find people endlessly fascinating. I care about people a lot. Yeah, I like people.
You know, I've known John now for about 8 or 9 years, and while I didn't know John before his stroke, one of the reasons I wanted to do this book was because I kept in touch with John through all these years, and I saw him change. And I think one of the things, in addition to his art really deepening and broadening, and his talent really flourishing, is that I noticed slowly in John an ability to reconnect with people. When I first met him, he was very much self-absorbed, and I think John in some ways would probably say that he still is, but he didn't as easily connect with people. Now John will call me up and ask me, how are you doing, and ask me questions about myself in ways that he didn't think to do, you know, years ago. So I actually think that John has made progress in that regard.
Amy, as part of the research for your book about John, you've spoken to many experts on the brain. You've really kind of tried to investigate exactly what happened when he had the stroke, which parts of his brain were affected, and how has that affected his perceptions and what he does as an artist, his relations with other people. So I want to ask you to describe for us, based on what you know, what parts of his brain were affected by the stroke.
One thing that the scientists have discovered who have taken brain scans of John's brain is that his heart stopped twice after his stroke. So he has areas of the brain, all over the brain, that were deprived of oxygen. The primary damage was to his left hemisphere, and in particular to the left side of the cerebellum. What was really interesting in my research was learning about what scientists are now finding out with regard to the cerebellum. What some of the research into the cerebellum has shown is that it carries our associations with sensory systems, how we track movements in the world around us. And part of the deficit, I think, that John has is that his relationship to the environment, to the world, is literally fresh every moment. It's unfamiliar. He experiences the world almost as if it's new every day. Objects around him, people, movement, what he hears, what he sees, are very much experienced in a kind of fresh way that's extraordinary for an artist.
Now, that sounds lovely in one way. Everything is fresh and new, but it also sounds like things might not have context or meaning, or there might be an inability to have a synthesis of what you're perceiving.
Terry?
Yeah?
That's tremendously insightful. That's you. Man, I'm impressed. I mean, that is... You're absolutely the correct, and I'm blown away that you were able to perceive that.
So is that, that's what it feels like, that everything's fresh
yeah.
and new, but there's no
yeah.
context, no synthesis?
That's exactly right. Everything is new, but because everything is new, everything is alien. You can't have one without the other, you know?
Alien sounds kind of scary, that if everything's alien,
well,
everything's
like,
potentially
remember,
threatening,
you ever,
maybe.
You know the Alice in Wonderland story? She falls down the rabbit hole, and everything is cool, but everything is weird, too.
Mm-hmm. But there's a sense of perpetual weirdness that you're describing. If you go to a new place, and it's weird at first, you're disoriented, you don't know your way around, you stay for a while... You get the lay of the land, it's familiar, it becomes more comfortable. You never get that feeling?
My learning curve in that regard is very slow and bad. You know, there's a lot of things I can't do that other people can do because my learning curve is so hindered.
Give me an example.
I can't drive.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember where I put things. If you tell me a phone number, before my stroke, I could remember the phone number, but now I need to write it down. Because I lose things very easily from my wallet, I need to put a rubber band around my wallet. Stuff like that, really simple. The same kind of thing where people put a tie string around their finger to remember something. My wife always puts the car keys in the refrigerator so she knows where they are. Same kind of stuff. Simple, mundane, prosaic coping mechanisms that get you through life. I have to do those more than I did before.
John, when you see, do you have visual distortions?
Yep. My stroke left me with double vision. I see two images of everything. One of my favorite examples is I remember I was waiting in line, and I saw this guy with a really long ponytail, and I said, wow, that's a really long ponytail. But it was actually a woman that was in front of him. I couldn't see her face, but because I don't have depth perception, I saw it as a ponytail on the guy. And I've utilized that loss of depth perception and the weird way I see things with my art.
One of the ways of looking at what happened to John, and this is a little bit simplistic, but... Because so much of the damage was to the left side of his brain, the side of the brain that a scientist sort of called the interpreter, responsible for linear reasoning and routine, rehearsed processing, whereas the right side of the brain is more intuitive, instinctual. It deals with novel situations that it then sort of passes over to the left side to figure out and make sense of. In a way, John is stuck in the right hemisphere. It's through his right hemisphere, through the instinctive part, through the artistic part, through the part that responds to immediate sensations, that he's trying to work out the meaning of life, the meaning of his environment. And because of that, it's a kind of constant, he'll be using different images in his art that he'll repeat over and over, a kind of perseveration. But in essence, it's John's brain trying to figure out what it is and who he is. Aristotle said that nature abhors a vacuum. If that's the case, then the brain absolutely abhors a mystery. It's always trying to figure out what's going on. When something is damaged, it tries to fill it in. The brain essentially is creating stories. And that's what John is doing through his art. In essence, it's the story, the continuing story, his continuing journey of who he is.
Amy, can I ask you to describe one of John's paintings or sketches that you think is a good illustration of what's going on in his mind?
That's really difficult to do. You know, some of the iconic things in John's art are, first of all, repetition of words. There's often a playfulness, a very witty use of language. He brings in a lot of his literary background, things that he's read that he remembers. But then he'll bring in, it's fractured, it's pieces, and it's like he's constantly putting a puzzle together. So he'll have, you know, cartoon faces with, you know, tubes running sort of in and out of their face, their mouth, their eyes, which is very reminiscent of the months that he spent in the hospital connected to wires and tubes. And then there's the use of constant the cross-hatching over and over and over, which is, you know, something that John has to keep doing. He literally has to keep doing art. It's what defines him. It is who he is. And in a way, one of the most iconic things about John's art are the words, for instance, the name Rauschenberg. And John explained it to me once. He really, first of all, he likes the artist very much. But he likes the word because he doesn't have to lift his pen off the page to write it. That's how compulsive and important it is for him to do art, that even the moment it takes to lift your pen off the page to dot an I or to cross a T takes John away from who he is.
John, one of your pieces says, Warhol, Dylan, Clancy, your dreams of sonar. Now, I have no idea what that means. What does that mean to you?
Well, let's break it down. Warhol, you get that, right?
Yeah, Andy Warhol.
Okay, so what's the next word?
Dylan, Bob Dylan.
Right.
Clancy, I'm not sure which Clancy that is, whether it's
Clancy,
the Clancy musician,
you know,
the Clancy
song,
writer.
It was a song by the Buffalo Springfield called Nowadays Clancy Can't Even Sing. You know that song?
I don't think I remember that one, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's... Okay, what's next?
Your dreams of sonar.
I don't know.
You don't know either.
I can't help you in that regard. But a lot of it is just because I probably made sense to me at the time, but just what I find interesting is the associations you make. As Amy said, the brain, we tell stories. Our brain is forced to find patterns to tell stories. And because those words are completely stream of consciousness, not sequiturs, we have to make sense of the thing that makes no sense. So that's why I find fascinating how, like, people that are into stream of consciousness stuff, like I or like James Joyce or whoever, do things, and then the reader or the perceiver makes their own story about the thing that really has no story.
Right, because what I read made no sense to you.
Right, if it doesn't make sense to me, you're on your own.
Okay.
You know, like Monet was always painting the Rouen Cathedral over and over and over. He was always trying to capture the moment. And he said that he wished he had been born blind and then suddenly gained his sight so that he could sort of see things fresh and see objects that he had never seen before. That's how John experiences the world. He does experience it, really, moment to moment to moment.
John, this is a weird question to ask, but do you see your art as an expression of symptoms of your stroke?
Yeah. It's a manifestation of what happened to me. There's no question about it. I've learned how to visually represent my existential dilemma caused by my stroke.
Do you wish you could find a cure that would, you know, like give the perceptual synthesis that you want, the cohesion that you want, and that would also, quote, cure your art? Do you know what I mean? You probably would not have that compulsion anymore to make the art. So
yeah, but the thing is, when I found that when I entertain that question, it makes me sad and it makes me miss what I've lost. And I've disciplined myself not to go there because it always takes me down a road that goes to a dead end. And I've learned that to stop going down that road. That's why I draw all the time, because the drawing is a compulsion that takes me away from thinking about that stuff.
And you choose not to do the kind of hypothetical what if. But can you look into the future at all? Or is that hard to do as well?
I can, but it's the same thing. I choose not to because it's counterproductive for me. My art is all about what's happening right now. And if I think about the future, it detracts from my experience of the now.
So just to get a sense, we're talking about compulsive art here, so just to get a sense of how compulsive, like how much art do you do a day?
Well, it's funny. When my daughter, my youngest daughter, learned how to count, her counting system was 1, 2, too much. So I would have to go with her counting system here. I haven't done one painting. I haven't done two paintings, but I've done too much paintings.
I get the point.
A lot.
Nevertheless, Amy, can you give us the more accurate accounting?
Oh, my God. John is right. John says he dreams about art. It's what he thinks about when he wakes up, and it's what he's thinking about when he goes to sleep at night. But John can take a thick artist's book and, you know, certainly in a day have drawn on each page. And he has a different kind of process. He doesn't usually deal with one thing at a time. He'll go through one page and another page with the same color pen doing different things, and then he'll go back and add to each one. But John recently, just to give you an idea, John recently, whenever he goes away, he goes away with his family a couple of times a year, he takes his art with him. He takes his art supplies with him. And he had, I believe, and John, you can correct me, I think somewhere he had 34 pieces of wood, little square pieces of wood. And he was away for, I think, you know, 5 days, maybe 6 days. And he did a portrait on each one of those. He said he lost several of them, so he only has 29 now. But I've seen them, and they're exquisite, and they're detailed. And, you know, that's the kind of profusion of art that comes out of John.
And they're all the same portrait.
But different?
A little bit different. But in answer to your question, recently there's a newspaper article about me, and she said, I don't know where she got this number from, she said he's done 70,000 pieces of art.
Whoa.
And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, I was talking to my wife, and I said, what do you think about the 70,000 number? My wife said, maybe it's too big, but maybe it's too small. I don't know.
Well, you know, here's the thing about you. When I visited John up in Gloucester once, he kept his art in like a storage room. And when I say kept his art, it was thrown in there up to the ceiling. I mean, you could barely open the door to get in. You know, John does something and then he moves on. In his studio, he'll have piles of his art, you know, in the corner. He'll have art on the floor. And, you know, sometimes he'll step across something and he'll make a footprint and he'll think, oh, that's good. I like that. You know, that adds to it. So, you know, John's art literally is all around him. I would suggest that 70,000 might be conservative.
Amy, did you take any of John's art to the neurologists and scientists who you consulted in doing the research for your book?
Yes, I'm Alice Flaherty up at Harvard, for one. But I actually first learned about John through through a scientist, through a neurologist, who Todd Feinberg. I was doing a story about the search for consciousness for the Star Ledger, the newspaper where I work. And I noticed on his wall a piece of art that was really intriguing. It was turned out to be a series of, I thought it was abstract, it turned out to be a series of 1950s Cadillac fins, which is a common John Sarkin theme. And when I asked him about it, Feinberg told me how he had been contacted by John after, oddly enough, appearing on your show, talking about his book, Altered Egos, which is about stroke patients who have suffered identity disorders. And John heard that and called him up and said, I'd like you to explain me to me. That's been hard for people to do. But I think one of the things that people come away with when they do see John's art is the sense of compulsion, almost hypergraphic, and the feeling that John needs to get all this out.
I think an issue that's very important for each of you is how does the brain create a self? Like, we have an identity, we have self-awareness, and that's situated someplace in the brain, nobody knows where. Like, mm-hmm. Researchers are trying to find, like, what is the site of consciousness in the brain, and nobody really knows. But I was wondering if you feel that, Amy, your research have given you any insights or raised questions that you'd never thought about before about what creates the self.
A lot of people, philosophers, scientists, consider the hard problem of consciousness, how subjectively we can understand the objective consciousness, impossible. You know, William James, the great philosopher, psychologist, once said that trying to understand consciousness was like trying to see the dark by turning on the light. You know, as soon as you do, you obliterate it. But one thing I discovered in doing the research and also in spending so much time with John is that I think we can talk about a sense of self with some validity. And profoundly, I've discovered through John, and I think through the way brain behavior in patients who have lost a sense of themselves, is that the way we connect is through imagination, through stories, whether it's our brain trying to explain something that doesn't make sense, whether it's through singing songs, painting pictures, but that essentially our brains are storytelling devices. That's how it works. And when we lose a sense of ourselves, to get it back, we sort of have to create the story of ourselves in order to understand it. We have to rewrite the narrative.
John, one of the things I find really just amazing about your story is the transformation. I mean, so many of us have tried really hard to make changes, fundamental changes in who we are, you know, to be more, you know, whether it's something like just to be neater and less disorganized, or to be happier and less sad, or you know, to you know, work more on being more physically fit, or whatever, you know, like from the superficial to the profound, and those changes, they're just it's really hard to change yourself. And you always feel like you're wired a certain way, no matter how hard you change. It's hard to create new patterns of behavior. It's hard to fundamentally change who you are. But you had this fundamental change against your will. It happened as a result of, you know, damage to your brain caused by a stroke. But you had this fundamental change. And so the self can change whether we wanted to or not, but sometimes it's something that happens to us as a result, as opposed to something that we've tried to do that's behind the change. Because this was not change that you sought, it wasn't like, I will try to be a better this or that, or I will try to... it just happened to you. Did you feel like a stranger to yourself for a while?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when Amy was saying how for a long time I was totally self-absorbed and I gradually changed, I'm getting better at compensating for what happened to me. Initially, it was the feeling of strangeness, of being so different than I was before, was alarming. It really took some getting used to. I really upset my wife, my family, my friends, because my behavior was so bizarre and so dramatically different. I've learned how to not be that way and to be more comfortable with who I am now. I've learned coping mechanisms, and I've learned how to compensate for the difference. But when the difference first happened, I was unable to do that kind of stuff.
I just want to give you one other quick example of John's way of thinking. Very recently, John and I were together driving somewhere, and not sure what we were talking about, but he said, you know, I really like the ocean because it doesn't have a strong opinion. And I understood what John meant, but it's a very different way of thinking of an inanimate object, that it's just there, you can interact with it the way you want to, you know, it's unchanging. But to John, the ocean doesn't have a strong opinion, and that's his expression of it.
John, Amy did so much research about the brain and about your brain to write the new book, Shadows Bright as Glass. What did you learn from her research about yourself?
Well, I thought the thing that I learned the most about the book was the book is not just the straight biography about me. It's using me as a jumping-off point to talk about the whole history of neuroscientific endeavor. And I'm starting to see myself in that fabric and in that pageant of pushing the ball ahead as far as what our understanding of the brain is. So I'm not seeing myself as singular as I did before, but more of a fractal of the whole of brain understanding.
And Amy, what did you learn about the brain that you found most remarkable?
You know, it's kind of a corny answer, but the resilience of the brain and the paradox of it. On the one hand, the brain, you know, it develops. You know, at 6 weeks in utero, we have the nervous system of a shrimp. And by puberty, our brains are the most complex objects in the universe. You know, with enough blood vessels to stretch from Philadelphia to Portland, Maine, and, you know, nerve fibers that would circle the globe four times. So on the one hand, the brain is also runs on about 20 watts of energy, which is basically enough to, you know, your refrigerator light come on. It's slower than electricity through wire. And yet you know, it creates Shakespeare's sonnets and plays, Newton's mathematics, Mozart's music. So I think I learned that, the brain is paradoxical in that respect, but also tremendously resilient. There was one story that struck me in particular in my research, and it was a few years ago, a woman in a hospital in Boston in her 30s was profoundly, profoundly disabled in a vegetative state her entire life because she was basically born without either hemisphere, just her brain stem and a clump of tissue on it. She was insensate to touch, to pain, obviously couldn't speak and was blind. And she was being sort of reassessed by doctors, and they asked another neurologist to come in to examine her. And for some reason, someone opened a child's music box in her room. And for the first time in 30 years, this woman turned to it and smiled. And this it was extraordinarily moving to this scientist. And he then made sure for the rest of this woman's life, which was just a few years, that there was always music in her room, you know, classical or modern music, because she responded to that. So here is a human being that you can question. Who is she? What is she? Does she even have a self when all she has is basically a brainstem and yet was moved by music and made a connection because someone else reached in to find her? And I think that taught me that, you know, the brain can lose everything. You can have so much damage. You can barely have a brain, and yet you can have a self.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Sarkin, Amy Ellis-Nutt, thank you both.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Amy Ellis-Nutt is the author of a new book about John Sarkin called Shadows Bright as Glass, The Remarkable Story of One Man's Journey from Brain Trauma to Artistic Triumph. You can read an excerpt on our website, where you'll also find a link to Sarkin's artwork. That's freshair.npr.org. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews a new box set of Ernie Kovacs' pioneering comedy shows from the 1950s. This is Fresh Air. From 1950 until he died in an auto accident in 1962, Ernie Kovacs created some of the most inventive and unusual television ever made. That was true then, and it's just as true half a century later, says our TV critic David Bianculli. A new DVD box set collects more than 13 hours of the TV pioneer's best and rarest programs. And David, who also teaches TV history, couldn't be more thrilled.
Do
me.
If you don't know who Ernie Kovacs is and never saw his brilliantly bizarre TV specials, the music you're hearing now, an otherwise obscure Italian song called Solfeggio, won't be associated with any specific images. But if you know Ernie, you're doubtlessly conjuring up pictures of one of his signature recurring bits, the Nairobi Trio. It's nothing more than three people wearing gorilla masks, pretending to play the song while one of them, the conductor, gets hit over the head at the end of each verse. Describing it doesn't make it sound funny. You have to see it. And even then, you have to share Ernie's sense of the absurd. More than anyone else in the 50s and 60s, he stressed and played with the vision part of television. He was the first special effects artist on TV, the first one to play, really play, with all these newfangled cameras and videotapes and other toys. But Ernie Kovacs was so, so much more than that. And a new box set from Shout Factory, called the Ernie Kovacs Collection, makes that case superbly. If all Ernie did was push the medium of TV into new directions, with quickly edited blackout sketches that later were copied by Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and with full-length music videos that predated MTV by more than 20 years, that would have been enough. But he had other amazing gifts as well. As a sketch comic, his recurring characters were memorably, daringly original. He would put on silly costumes and sillier accents to play everyone from TV horror film host Uncle Gruesome to movie star Rock Mississippi. And more than a generation before In Living Color gave us the openly gay movie critics of Men in Film, Ernie Kovacs gave us TV's proudly prissy poet laureate, Percy Dovetonsils.
It's so nice to link pinkies via the Orthicon tube, as the expression goes. Certainly, it is nice to join once again with you out there. I was reminiscing only this morning.
And Ernie Kovacs had a third great talent, perhaps his most underrated one. When he was himself, talking to the camera, he not only was a natural, he looked natural. He talked conversationally, not like an announcer. And he sat there, looking directly into the camera, and talked matter-of-factly about a lot of things, including television. In that way, he was doing in the 50s and 60s what Jon Stewart is doing now. Looking around at the TV landscape and pointing out its failures and its excesses by making fun of it. Here's Ernie, speaking from the TV control room as the director next to him calls out shots, setting up one of several sketches in a 1961 show about TV, sex, and violence.
Actually, it isn't so much that there's an excess of sex and violence in these various media. It's really that there isn't quite enough. Now, if there were more, we wouldn't notice it so much. Now, let's take, for instance, the weather forecasts.
And at this point, the camera cuts to Jolene Brand, one of the lovely ladies who was part of Ernie's repertory company, reclining on a plush couch. She's wearing a sheer, sexy nightgown, and as she talks, the camera pulls in closer and closer on her face. By the time she's finished, all we see are her lips.
Hi, weather lovers. About that sunshine today, Crazy. I don't know how to tell you this, but we might have a little rain tonight. Old Pluvius is in there pitching. You see, we have this low pressure area. Then we have this high pressure area. They just don't make the scene. Cuckoo. It was 78 in California today. 74 in New Jersey. 21. Ooh. 21. 21 in Alaska, and 108 in Georgia. Try to keep cool.
Ernie Kovacs started in TV in Philadelphia in 1950 and hosted an early morning TV show, Three to Get Ready, that was the first TV morning show anywhere, not just in Philly. From there, and for the next dozen years, he hopped all over the dial. Whenever one network let him go, another would just as eagerly grab him up, because absolutely no one was doing what Ernie did. This brilliant new Shout Factory collection includes the earliest surviving work by Ernie Kovacs, most of his classics, and so much bonus material that it's absolutely invaluable. The Ernie Kovacs collection is a mandatory purchase for anyone who loves television and wants to experience some of its richest comedy roots. But as I see it, it's also almost a public service. Sadly, there's nowhere to see Ernie Kovacs on television these days. Not on TV Land, Nick at Night, or any other network that ought to be proud to keep that legacy alive. We TV history teachers try to do our part. But now, thanks to Shout Factory, you can have a graduate course on Ernie Kovacs in the privacy of your own home. And there's no final exam. Just a ridiculous number of laughs.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com. He teaches TV history and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. He reviewed the new DVD box set, The Ernie Kovacs Collection. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track featuring violinist Billy Bang from his album Prayer for Peace. Bang died last Monday at the age of 63 of complications from lung cancer.